21 dead in a shootout south of the border involving Mexican forces and drug cartels. Drug-related violence or terrorism at the Texas border? That story today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. What's in a name? Though President Trump has threatened to designate Mexico's drug cartels terrorist organizations, people in Mexico view the violence through a more complicated lens, according to a new survey. We'll have the latest. Also, the outline of the AR-15, a form factor in the debate over gun control, now facing another test before the Supreme Court. And the Texas Ranch Sisterhood. All those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started. Right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this second day of December. I'm David Brown. Thanks so much for spending your first day of the work week with us. Over the weekend, an attack in London made headlines. Several people stabbed near London Bridge, too fatally, by someone who appeared to have been wearing a hoax explosive device. The incident, now designated as an act of terrorism by the government. In the immediate aftermath of such incidents, the question often arises, is this an act of terrorism? Well, what is terrorism? How would you define it? U.S. law defines terrorist activity as the assassination or use of explosives, firearms, or other weapons with the intent to endanger individuals, government agencies, or do damage to property, among other things, like murdering or injuring people to keep them from doing some act. The U.S. State Department has the authority to designate a group that regularly engages in such activity as a foreign terrorist organization, FTO. Last month, President Trump threatened to declare Mexico's drug cartels FTOs, foreign terrorist organizations, which could mean that an American and an inner-city gang selling street drugs that originated from south of the border could be prosecuted under anti-terrorism laws, perhaps even getting a life sentence. But look, that's just one implication. Another. One of grave concern to our neighbors in Mexico is that the designation might be used to justify U.S. military adventurism against the cartels, something Mexico's president says his country will not tolerate. This could be an entirely academic matter were it not for what seems to be a growing concern that cartel-related violence is spiraling out of control. Not far from the border with Texas, case in point, what happened over the weekend in a small town in Coahuila, a 60-minute drive or so southwest of Eagle Pass, Texas. It was an hour-long shootout between highly armed members of a well-known drug cartel and police, backed up by federal firepower. It left more than 20 dead and an entire town pockmarked with bullet holes. Joining us now, Alfredo Corchado, the Mexico border correspondent for the Dallas Morning News. Alfredo, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks, David.
What's known about this cartel attack? Well, what prompted it and why did it happen?
Well, we know that's some kind of turf war between the Gulf cartel and the remnants of what used to be the Zetas. That's more of a Zetas stronghold. And obviously the Gulf cartel is trying to get trying to use that route to obviously bring drugs into Texas. But it was a pretty bloody thing, and it happened on the weekend when President Lopez Obrador was celebrating his first year in office.
You know, this also comes after nine members of a Mexican-American Mormon family were killed by cartel members, right? And then, of course, you have, as I was talking about there, Donald Trump saying he wanted to classify cartels as terrorist groups. How's this going over in Mexico?
Well, it's not going well. I mean, President Lopez Obrador has been very emphatic, saying, you know, there have been no foreign invasion intervention in Mexico since 1914, and he is not going to allow that. He's not going to allow any kind of intervention into the territory. But it's interesting that the Attorney General William Barr will be in Mexico this week, so that's going to be something, you know, to watch closely as to what takes place, how the Mexicans react to that. The Mexicans have been very, very careful not to play into the Trump, you know, trying not to let Trump incite them. Mm-hmm. So they've been using very diplomatic language. Some people would say they're appeasing the administration, but Mexico is caught in a very tough situation. You know, you go after the U.S. or you bring on the nationalistic fervor. It may help you for a few weeks, for a few months, but at the end, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of jobs that are at stake.
But at the same time, I mean, how do Mexican citizens feel about the violence in their country? I mean, they're certainly not passive about this, but is there any indication of their own sentiment and how they connect it with the Mexican government?
Absolutely. I mean, we just did a poll over the weekend, the Dallas Morning News and Reforma newspaper with the help of SMU, and found that surprisingly, López Obrador remains incredibly popular, I think 68%, yet 68% of the Mexicans poll said that the insecurity, the issue of security, the issue of violence, it's the number one priority. I mean, that's the red herring, security and the economy, but especially security. I mean, and it's not just that people are concerned about, you know, in the traditional states, which are the northern states, but this is all over the country. Yet, for some reason, they don't put AMLO security on the same page. I mean, they still separate them. And that's a phenomenon that I think we're trying to understand. I think most people we interview say, you know, these are two different things. AMLO is such a likable guy. He dresses like us. He eats like us, as one analyst told us. Mm-hmm. And he's trying hard. We have to give him the benefit of doubt. How long that lasts, I don't know. I mean, this is the first year of a 6-year term. I don't think Mexicans will feel this way if the numbers continue to grow. I mean, Mexico is on the brink of marking the worst year in violence since it's been counted in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. We're close to, I think, 33,000 people killed in 1 year, which is remarkable.
Alfredo Corchado is Mexican border correspondent for the Dallas Morning News. We're going to link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Alfredo, thanks again.
Thank you, David.
Hey, in a couple of weeks, Houstonians will elect a mayor and several city council members in a runoff election, but one undecided race won't be on the ballot. Why not? Houston Public Media's Jen Rice explains.
For residents in one Houston City Council district, the question has become pressing. Can a candidate with a felony conviction run for office in Texas? More on the Houston race in a second, but first, let's hear from one Texas state senator who says absolutely not, felons shouldn't run for office.
A finally convicted felon is not eligible to be a candidate for public elected office in the state unless they have been pardoned or otherwise released from their resulting disabilities.
Pat Fallon is a Republican from Denton and says virtually no one knows what that part of the election code means.
The resulting disabilities line is unclear and without legal precedent causing confusion as to who is exactly eligible to run for public office.
Earlier this year, during the legislative session, Fallon wanted to settle the question and put it in state law. People with felony convictions don't deserve the right to run for office.
They have broken their pact with society in a very egregious manner and should not have certain rights restored.
He pushed for the measure because of a situation very similar to what's happening in Houston now. Last year in Austin, Lewis Conway Jr. ran for city council, and he had a felony conviction on his record. He testified against Fallon's bill.
No matter what we do, in his eyes, we are forever second-class citizens, slaves, if you will. And these lowly second-class citizens that have been punished and served their time, how dare they seek public office?
Conway didn't make the runoff, so Austin didn't have to figure out what would have happened if he'd won. And Fallon's bill failed, so now the unanswered question is resurfacing, this time in a courtroom in Houston. The two candidates in Houston's District B runoff are Tarsha Jackson and Cynthia Bailey. In 2007, Bailey was convicted of theft and sentenced to 10 years in prison. The third-place candidate, Renee Jefferson Smith, is contesting the election results because she says Bailey isn't eligible and that she perjured herself by signing a sworn statement when she filed to run for office. Nicole Bates, Jefferson Smith's attorney, says the city could have avoided a special election.
They've been unresponsive, and I'll just leave it at that. But there are things in the code that require the city to do something, and that just hasn't been done.
I tried to find out from the Texas Secretary of State's office and Houston City Attorney if Bailey's eligible to run. Both refused to answer. Bailey says she is eligible. In Texas, convicted felons regain the right to vote when they complete parole, and Bailey argues she got her eligibility to run back at the same time. At least, that is how it works in 23 other states. Margaret Love is a former pardon attorney in the U.S. Justice Department who runs the Restoration of Rights Project.
Most frequently, the pattern is that the right to vote and the right to hold office travel together.
Love told me she had a client with a felony conviction who sat on Pittsburgh City Council for 12 years. Nicole Porter with the national advocacy group The Sentencing Project says something similar happened in D.C.
Where I live, our former mayor was convicted of a federal drug offense and then subsequently was elected to the city council.
Porter says Houston City Council race is part of a bigger trend.
Candidates are publicly disclosing their criminal conviction history. I think that's part of an ongoing effort to destigmatize prior justice involvement. That's a part of the movement to challenge mass incarceration.
Cynthia Bailey is part of that movement, but so is Tarsha Jackson, the frontrunner in the race. She's a criminal justice reform advocate who says life is already hard enough for people with felony convictions, who often face limited job and housing opportunities. She says Bailey deserves a second chance and a place on the ballot. I'm Jen Rice in Houston.
Let's find out what Texans are talking about on this Monday. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. We're keeping an eye on the situation in Port Neches, some 80 miles outside of Houston, where an explosion at a chemical plant there Wednesday continues to burn. The blast at the TPC Group plant injured three workers, but all have since been released. And it was severe enough to shatter windows on homes and storm fronts. Mm. Many folks online also noting the explosion came shortly after the Trump administration rescinded new rules put in place following the deadly West Texas fertilizer plant explosion in 2013. On our Facebook page, Stephen Robinson says, I live within the 4-mile radius of evacuation. I was about 2 miles away from the second explosion. It rocked the entire building. I know this was not an effect of Trump's recent deregulations, but I'm not sure why anyone thinks deregulating safety standards is a good thing. And Derek Ross Hall, also via our Facebook page, shares a description. The fires are contained today. There's still some smoke, but it's very difficult to see any visible flames from outside the plant. The locals are cleaning up and filing insurance claims, and lawyers are circling. Aside from that, it's pretty much business as usual after the weekend. Well, you know what else is proceeding as business, I should say, is Cyber Monday. Lots of folks chiming in on that insanity, if you will. So, reactions about that and more stories from social later in the show.
In fact, in about 35 minutes or so, Wells Dunbar will be joining us once again with more of your comments from across the Lone Star State. Let us hear from you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network of physicians treating more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year with technology and cancer-fighting care options. More at TexasOncology.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. There are 1.6 million veterans in Texas, the second highest number of veterans in any state in the U.S. Often overlooked challenges they face on the home front, literally at home. Veterans are more than 60% more likely to separate or divorce than non-veterans. Now there's an effort to try to deal with that issue. For the American Homefront Project, Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports.
The 27 couples in this windowless hotel conference room don't seem to have a lot in common. They range from their 20s to their 70s and speak nervously to those seated at their tables. Some of the older ones sport hats touting their veteran status. But when a microphone gets passed around, they share similar stories of pain.
I have PTSD, anger issues, trouble a lot of times controlling my emotions.
That's Marine Corps veteran John Browning, who saw combat in Vietnam. He and his wife Barbara have been married more than 50 years and have survived a long list of surgeries and mental health setbacks.
I hope to improve my communication skills and maybe to get more understanding of how to be a better husband.
Barbara dabs her face with a Kleenex as she takes the microphone.
He never told me what he went through in Vietnam till he went to pieces.
Since he retired, his symptoms have made him hard to live with. On top of this, Barbara has early stage Alzheimer's and doesn't know how they'll get by once it progresses.
We just want to be close together always.
This is Warrior to Soulmate, a free VA program that teaches intimacy building skills in a group setting. It's tailored to the needs of veteran couples and reaches about 1,200 people per year. It's existed for a while, but this summer the VA announced plans to offer more family services. Now it's training more people to provide couples counseling and lead programs like Warrior to Soulmate. The VA saw more than 30,000 veterans for family and couples therapy in 2019. Faith Lane is a clinical social worker with the VA and a facilitator for the program.
There's an exceptionally high rate of divorce among active military and veterans.
Post-traumatic stress, the strain of repeated deployments, injuries, and medication issues can be challenging for couples. And sometimes spouses become caregivers, changing the dynamics of a relationship. VA chaplain Randy Holloway says behaviors vets learn in the military can make it hard for them to communicate with their partners later on.
You don't show emotion, you don't do that. You just get the job done. Mission comes first. And so there's a disconnect a lot of times in the home.
That's the case for Army veteran Abraham Cruz and his wife, Maria. They've come to Warrior to Soulmate to start finding their way back to one another, now that Abraham's retired after years of deployment. But there's one area that's off limits, his combat experiences.
I decided not to bring whatever happened there to bring it to the house.
Abraham carries with him the violence of his past, but doesn't share details in Maria's presence.
I talked to other soldiers. They understand the complexities of making certain decisions in combat and what it means to take a human life. It changes you.
The couple seems to agree that with certain things, you can't unring the bell.
There are boundaries and there's stuff I don't need to know. And I don't want to know because then I might look at him differently. And I don't want to look at him differently.
What she needs to know is that she's loved and that scenario didn't affect me to the point that she can't love me.
Maria and Abraham say they're taking the lessons of Warrior to Soulmate to heart and have connected more during the retreat than they have in years. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration reporting on American military life and veterans with funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing arguments in a case that many think could limit the scope of gun control laws. One weapon in particular has become a centerpiece in this conversation, the AR-15. Guns in America's Jonathan Levinson looks at how the shape of the rifle itself is shaping our debate.
John Bush is a gunsmith in Vancouver, Washington. He's fitting a handgun with a new custom trigger.
A few minutes ago, this didn't fit.
Bush says in the 6 years he's been in business, he's seen the popularity of AR-15s surge. And he gets it. He's a competitive shooter, and his AR-15 is great for that.
Any platform you can shoot faster and accurate for competition gives you an edge.
But he says it's really not ideal for hunting. He thinks people love their ARs for other reasons. It's an image.
Yeah, it's got that little tactical look to it, and you can go out and see the range ninjas playing around and everything.
The AR-15 is a semi-automatic rifle that usually shoots 5.56 millimeter rounds. It has a detachable magazine, so users can put in a 5, 10, 30, or even a 60-round magazine. The AR lets people customize it however they want. It's a bit of a running joke in the firearms community.
I get ARs in here that weigh 20 pounds that have so much on them.
Bush says this obsession with how the gun looks is most obvious when you compare the AR-15 to another gun, the Mini-14. That's also a semi-automatic rifle, but it has a wood frame. It looks more like your grandpa's hunting rifle than something SEAL Team 6 might carry.
Again, they operate the exact same way. More often than not, they shoot the same round, too, with the same capacity. One's just scary looking.
The Mini-14 is neither adored nor vilified. Most people have never heard of it. Kirsten Munchinger is a product design professor at the University of Oregon. She studies how guns hold emotional significance for Americans.
That's an aspect of what you're looking for in your newly designed product is craveability, and it triggers some emotional response.
Today, the emotional response that sells guns is about war.
We are warriors, shouldered by the bravest of the brave. We are tortured, tested on the battlefield.
This is an FN Herstal commercial from 2016. They're a Belgian company that makes civilian and U.S. military firearms.
The backbone of bravery.
FN is not alone. Firearms companies lean heavily on military imagery to attract customers. Tom Diaz was a staff attorney in the 1990s for the Congressional House Subcommittee on Crime and Criminal Justice. He says frequent imagery glorifying military violence can make violence seem normal.
There is a subset of people for whom I do think the bar has been lowered, partly through industry advertising, partly through incautious language by some of our leaders.
Violent imagery has also taken over the discussions around gun control, to the annoyance of some gun owners and the frustration of people trying to change laws.
Most of the politicians who deal with this issue, they don't really have a clue about guns.
Former Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke went on CNN recently to talk about the types of weapons he wants to ban after a mass shooting in his hometown of El Paso left 22 people dead.
When it comes to AR-15s and AK-47s, that belongs on the battlefield, does not belong in this country. But when it comes to firearms used for hunting or self-defense, the answer is no.
But O'Rourke doesn't explain what differentiates a hunting rifle from an AR-15. In 1994, Congress passed the 10-year assault weapons ban. The law listed a handful of specific makes and models and banned certain features. Tom Diaz worked on the bill, but didn't like its language.
The 1994 definition was ludicrous because it, you know, things like a bayonet mount, what the hell does that have to do with firepower? Almost nothing.
Most research concluded the ban didn't really work. Predictably, loopholes abounded. Firearms companies just tweaked their design a little to make them compliant. Diaz says people need to stop obsessing over looks and just ban the one capability that makes guns so deadly, high-capacity magazines.
Let's make it 8 rounds. No grandfathering, so all of these 10, 20, 30, 40, 60, 90, 100-round magazines become contraband after a grace period.
He says an AR loaded with 8 rounds is a whole different creature than an AR with 60. For Guns in America, I'm Jonathan Levinson.
Guns in America and our partner station, KERA, are spending 2 years reporting on the role of guns in American life. You can learn more at gunsandamerica.org. We are fast approaching 29 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. The roundup's next. Stick around.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texans have about 2 weeks left to buy health insurance through the Affordable Care Act marketplace. The plans are available to people who do not get coverage from their employer, Medicaid, or Medicare. Elena Marks, who leads the Episcopal Health Foundation, says enrollment for the plans has dropped each year under the Trump administration as it continues cutting funding to promote participation.
Between the reduction in those funds and the lawsuit filed by the state of Texas seeking to eliminate the ACA entirely has really had a depressive effect on enrollment in these marketplace plans.
During the last enrollment period, more than 1 million Texans purchased health plans. The deadline to enroll is December 15th. Defense attorneys for Greenpeace protesters who rappelled off a bridge over the Houston Ship Channel in September have a pretrial hearing this week. The activists are charged under a new state law that increases penalties for protesters who interfere with so-called critical infrastructure, such as pipelines. KUT's Mose Bouchel says the law includes more jail time.
Also, organizations that support you now can be charged a lot of money if it's shown that their support went towards your protest. People have raised a lot of concerns about this in terms of freedom of speech, people's ability to protest, and also, obviously, communities that are concerned about fossil fuels worry about this having a kind of chilling effect on their ability to raise those concerns.
Oil and gas groups say the law increases safety around infrastructure. The Texas General Land Office is getting feedback in Rockport this morning on its plan to spend billions of federal dollars for flood mitigation projects across the state. The field hearing is one of four scheduled this month in areas devastated by Hurricane Harvey and widespread flooding in 2015 and 2016. The GLO's Brittany X says the office is seeking public input before submitting its final plan for the block grant funding to the Department of Housing and Urban Development.
So we have $4.3 billion to look at things such as drainage improvement and large-scale watersheds, et cetera, to help make our state more resilient in future storms.
The GLO has hearings scheduled later this month in Dallas, Weslaco, and Houston. Responses can also be submitted online or by mail until January 6th. And federal agencies are investigating a plane crash last night in San Antonio that killed all three people on board. The city's fire chief says the single-engine aircraft flying from Sugar Land had diverted to the San Antonio airport due to a mechanical problem. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. This morning, I woke up to hear the not entirely surprising news of a shakeup in Longhorn country. Yes, Texas Longhorns football. And I thought two things. Number one, here we go again. Number two, I thought, I wonder what Darren Roberts thinks of all this. You know Darren, right? He's the founding director of the Center for Sports Leadership and Innovation at the University of Texas at Austin. Always good to have you back in the studio, Darren. Good to see you, sir.
Great to be back. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving.
You too. What do you make of all this? That was what I was thinking.
So this is the day that's known as Black Sunday. So this is the Sunday after the last regular season game. You know, a 7-5 season. I know that the Longhorn faithful had a lot of high hopes for this year after going to the Big 12 championship game last year. So it's not surprising that Coach Herman made some pretty big moves. So defensive coordinator Todd Orlando out. Tim Beck demoted to coaching quarterbacks. You've got one wide receivers coach fired and then another one reassigned.
I think the big surprise was not that he'd be shaking things up, but the scope, the scale of this. This is a lot of change.
Yeah, and I think that this really speaks to sort of the expectation of the Longhorn base, right?
Is it unrealistic? I mean, come on. I mean, I'm with you. I totally understand. This is about expectations. But have those expectations been ratcheted up so much over the years that it's almost harmful to the team because you have to do so many shakeups and so many,
You know, Texas is the epicenter of irrational exuberance, okay? And so I think that we, as a fan base, expect ourselves to be at the Alabama, the LSU sort of level where we're in contention each year. I think we have some work to do. We're in the richest hotbed of recruiting talent in the country. Yeah. So it can be done. There are great players who come out of the state of Texas and go on to the NFL and play for other teams. So I think it's just a matter of kind of putting all the pieces together, but it's going to take some time.
Hey, can I ask you about Alabama? Because you mentioned those. Yeah. What's going on with them?
I tell you what, when I watched that game, this was a classic case of Saban being out Saban. Okay. Mm. You know, Gus Malzahn, you got to give credit to him for getting his guys ready to play. You know, people will call it a trick play, but the last play in which he forced Alabama, you know, there was some confusion. They had 12 men on the field. That was masterful. And, you know, Saban's post-game conference, he said it was unfair. This was just good old football, and Gus out-coached Nick. And so we've got a big shakeup in the SEC.
I suppose before we leave football altogether, we need to talk about Dallas and the Bills. I had at a party on Thanksgiving night, and someone said, "Uh-oh, coach about to get fired." And as I understand it, right after the game, there was a lot of hollering in that locker room there in Dallas.
Yes. So the word out of Dallas is this, that unless Jason Garrett takes the Cowboys to the Super Bowl game and wins it, Jerry Jones will make a change. So I know that for a lot of those people driving around who are Cowboys fans, this makes them very excited and happy. This is a team that's underperformed. I mean, they've got arguably the best running back in the league, one of the emerging quarterbacks in the league. The defense has got some stout players, has underperformed, and I think that it will take a turnaround miracle in order for Jason Garrett to keep his job.
I seem to sense a theme here, great expectations. And yet, when you talk about big giants falling, what a game between Texas's Stephen F. Austin toppling a basketball powerhouse.
Yes.
Number one ranked Duke. Holy smokes.
And it's not even March, right? This is something that happens in March Madness. I mean, no one was expecting this to go down in November. Just a couple of numbers that I pulled. So, you know, Coach Krzyzewski's salary, $8.9 million. SFA head coach Kyle Keller's salary, $355K.
Whoa.
Okay. You know, I love these sorts of stories that happen because if you're the SFA basketball team, there's no reason for you to get on the plane, right? And I wrote about this on LinkedIn. I mean, everyone's telling you, hey, don't go to Duke. Don't go play Coach K. I mean, this guy has a winning streak going back to 2005 in terms of home wins, non-conference wins. And so, but they go up. And what I love about the last 5 seconds, guy steals the ball. And instead of calling a timeout, he goes right for the layup. And it's a shocker. So congrats to the guys in Nacogdoches. There will always be a situation of a David and Goliath matchup in which people around you will say, don't bother starting the company. Don't bother going back to get your master's. But it's those sorts of situations that really require us to step up. And what you'll find is once you start making some forward progress, and I think about the Lumberjacks, you build some momentum. And the next thing you know, you're closer to your goal than you were before you started listening to all the naysayers.
Yeah, don't listen.
Keep going.
Darren Roberts is founding director of the Center for Sports Leadership and Innovation, University of Texas at Austin. Darren, good to see you, sir. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. Life working the land. It's the stuff of Texas mythology, to be sure, but it's also a big part of the Texas story. In the 1950s, just as cowboys became commonplace on TV and in movies, Texas became, for the first time in its history, a mostly urban state. Been that way ever since. And the popular notion of the working ranch largely fixed as the work of weather-worn men. When Elisa Banta of Fort Worth began her project in 2016, she set out to document something different, a new look at the working ranches of Texas from a fresh perspective, a woman's perspective. What she didn't count on was the start of something bigger, the subject of her new book of portraits titled The Texas Ranch Sisterhood. Elisa Banta, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David. Glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit about the inspiration for wanting to document women on Texas ranches. What inspired you to go and meet some of these folks?
I think I was looking to see women in action, sort of strong, powerful, feminine, big stepping, able-bodied women in action. And I wanted to see how women could be feminine and powerful all at once. And I think being so Texas proud as I am, it took me out to the ranches.
You know, it's funny because I'm not sure that thought would have occurred to a lot of folks, given how male that archetype is. I mean, it or at least it seems to be in, you know, the popular consciousness of the rancher as a kind of a rugged man, you know?
Yeah, but you know, you got to figure, David, there's got to be women out there somewhere, right?
Of course, right.
They've got to be getting the job done like they do in so many levels, you know, in so many other parts of our society. Women just get it done. And so when I wandered out there, I started seeing them, and then one led to the next. And there's not too many of them, but there's a bunch working, and that's for sure. And they're not sitting at home. They're actually getting up every single day and putting days together, complicated days together for their men, for their kids, for their animals, and they work. They are working.
I mentioned that, and you talk about this in your introduction, what you didn't count on was the sort of friendships that would be forged as you went out trying to document the lives of these women ranchers. What did you find when you got out there? You sort of, it sounds like you found yourself sort of pitching right in and helping on some of these ranches.
I did on every single one of them. You know, if you go out to a working ranch and you're able-bodied at all, they'll put you to work. I promise. Even though you're startled when they suggest you do something because you have never done it before, they'll just hand you the tool or put you on an animal and say, come on, this way. And what I liked so much, I mean, none of these women knew me, and I didn't know, you know, we were at least three people removed from knowing each other. A friend of a friend of a friend knew somebody, kind of thing. And they opened up their houses immediately. I'd turn up on their front porch. mean, it was unbelievable. And as one woman said, Mitzi King out in Coleman, when she hugged me after not seeing me for a while, she's like, "We sure do love our people. Us country folks sure do love our people." And I really found that openness. It was just really a sincerity. It was so welcoming. They were so welcoming. They probably appreciated that I helped too and didn't complain. And I was all in all the time with them. Mm-hmm. But it was lovely. It was curative. It really was. It reminded us that it's not, you know, we are connected to each other. We're not just messages, phone calls, see you when I see you. We're actually connected to each other. And it was lovely. Truly it was, David.
Is that what you mean when you by the title Texas Ranch Sisterhood?
It is what I mean. I think, you know, those ladies are bound together through animals. They see each other maybe twice a year. They see each other at funerals, at weddings, and then maybe at a cattle raisers event. But there's such a bond. It's so evident. They're glad to see each other. They're glad to know each other. It's like it's more basic than we know in the city anymore. I mean, we're all so rush. That's so cliche. But they're just people. You know, come on by. Stop on by. Share a meal. Let's say hello. I got to go say hello to so-and-so. I'm going to run by their place. And it's great. And that's what I meant by sisterhood. Yes.
You have quite a bit of geographic diversity here. I mean, some of these folks live out west of Valentine, which is west mm-hmm. of Marfa, if you know the map. Some folks west of Carthage, I noticed. As you were going around the Lone Star State looking for these vignettes, I suppose, did one part of Texas, I mean, I know you're a native Texan, but was there a certain part of Texas that you found yourself especially sort of drawn to?
I think I fell in love with my state a little bit more. I mean, all throughout college and graduate school, we'd always go camping in Big Bend, which mm-hmm. is such a treasure. So out Marfa Way, Sonora, Alpine, Fort Stockton, I'd seen that area. Hadn't really seen Carthage. Made it down south to San Antone for some women that actually didn't make it into the book. I got to see Texas. It was like the biggest darn road trip. I mean, I was all over the place everywhere, and I was just... I was just so glad to see it, so happy to see it, so proud to see it. Again, living in Fort Worth, you know, it's just hunker down and grind, and don't really look up. I was able to look up for this whole time, a year and a half it took me doing this book, right, photographing and researching this book. And I was able to look up. I was able to look at our gorgeous big sky, our wide open spaces. Felt really great.
This is a clumsy question, but I'll ask it anyway. Do you think it's harder for a woman rancher than it is for her male counterpart?
I think the manual labor's there. They both do heavy lifting. I think what the women bring to it is everything else that women all over the place bring to everything we do, right? The caring, the nurturing, the family in the end. The boys do it too. The men are there providing, but the women are like putting band-aids on their toddlers, on their toddlers' knees. They're like combing their little girl's hair. They're doing all that on top of ranching full time. So is it harder? Maybe, but is it okay too? Yeah, it's okay too. I mean, women, no matter what we do, no matter what job we have, I think we do that job and then we bring our womenness to it.
Elisa, did this make you want to be a rancher?
In a way it did. I think I've got open invitations all over Texas, and I can go help at any point with any of them and get my fill of ranchhood. I mean, I would come back, David, from some of those gigs. Out in Coleman at the Hemp Hill Ranch. I mean, those people ride from dark to dark. So they ride before sunrise and put it away after sunset. And I would come back to Fort Worth sore. So anytime I want to feel that again, I think I'm welcome on any of these ranches.
The author is photojournalist Elisa Banta of Fort Worth, Texas. The book is titled The Texas Ranch Sisterhood, Portraits of Women Working the Land. Congratulations on the book. It's a real pleasure to get to go through it and to get to talk with you, Elisa. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I love doing this book. The ladies are all fantastic. I thank all of them, really.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Some people claim that the political future of Texas is a jump ball in 2020. While that may be something of an exaggeration, it's clear Republicans are playing defense, and word is out. Victories are no longer assured for the GOP in what was once described as the reddest of red states. But keeping with the jump ball analogy for just a moment, there are two players out there in center court, the state party chairs, each trying to tip the ball one direction or another. And as Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies reports, though their colors are different, their playbook is strikingly similar in at least one important respect.
In past elections, Texas Democratic Party Chairman Gilberto Hinojosa remembers how hard it was to find people who would run for office.
The old days, you know, I'd be on the phone trying to get somebody to run for some state rep slot, usually got no's from people.
This election, things are different.
We've got multiple candidates running for not just the targeted seats, but all the seats.
Hinojosa said this is a sign of a new enthusiasm that is cranking up the Democratic Party. The chairman of the Texas Republican Party, James Dickey, sees this, and he says he's not worried, but he's telling Texas Republicans to be on red alert.
That's the appropriate attitude I want people to have. I get asked frequently, is there a chance Texas could flip? And the answer, of course, is it could if Republicans take too much for granted, take voters for granted, and don't do the work necessary to spread our message and make our case.
Dickey says the Blue Wave 2018 midterm elections taught Texas Republicans a lesson. He's raising more money than ever before, hiring more full-time workers. Last election, the Texas GOP had 8 full-timers. In 2020, they will have 150.
That's one of the unique things that the party can, should, and must do, which is recruiting volunteers by the tens of thousands from all over the state, and working with those volunteers to recruit and persuade and activate voters that have not previously been reached.
But the Texas Republican Party is running against some headwinds generated by President Donald Trump, who remains popular with the base of the Republican Party, but is repelling many swing voters in the suburbs, which is where the Texas GOP saw its support crack in 2018. Dickey rejects that analysis.
All of the polling that shows that the president has a challenge in Texas have fundamental flaws in their construct.
But Hinojosa embraces it.
What we're seeing is a lot of people who, particularly in the suburbs, who have historically voted for Republicans because that was the only game in town, are now seeing the alternative in the Democratic Party, and that the alternative is much more in line with the way they believe.
Hinojosa says the Republican Party is going to try to win elections by making it harder for Democrats to vote. And he points to the new law that ends mobile early voting, which the Democratic Party is suing to overturn.
Rather than having a democracy where you increase people's opportunity to participate in this democracy, they want to decrease people's opportunity and make it very difficult for people to vote.
But Hinojosa said the ending of early mobile voting is actually likely to boomerang on Republicans and make it harder for voters in ruby-red rural counties to cast an early ballot. Dickey disagrees.
I'm confident that this change will make it so the voters have much more reliability and dependability for their voting locations, and that that will, in fact, result in higher rates of voting.
One thing the two chairmen agree on is about former Congressman Beto O'Rourke. The El Paso Democrat came close to unseating Senator Ted Cruz in 2018 and then flamed out in his presidential run. Both Dickey and Hinojosa said they don't know if O'Rourke is going to jump into the Democratic primary for Senate, and both said it wouldn't make much of a difference if he does. Dickey said O'Rourke shifted so far to the left running for president that he's out of bounds for Texas.
He is the worst kind of panderer and ultra-extremist leftist. And that means that regardless of what he does, it will not be a significant factor.
Hinojosa said the Senate primary is doing just fine right now without O'Rourke.
I think we got something like 12 candidates right now running for the Senate, and a great set of candidates that I think any one of which, if they become the nominee, can beat Mr. Cornyn.
Nevertheless, if O'Rourke tosses his hat into the race, he's got till December 9th to do it. That's the deadline for candidates to file. In San Antonio, David Martin Davies reporting.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Time to check in once again with our social media editor, Mr. Wells Dunbar. What are you hearing out there, Wells?
Hey, David. Well, we made it through Thanksgiving, Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, whatever Sunday was, and have landed here at Cyber Monday.
Cyber. I don't even like the word cyber.
No.
It sounds like something from the days of AOL, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. It sounds like some movie from the 1990s
yeah,
or something
exactly.
like that. Yeah. But, you know, cyber's not
there
going anywhere.
Cyber.
So let's see what folks are saying out there. In between breathless cyber inputs of their credit card information. In Austin, and Mulehorn Gaming calls Cyber Monday the day where if you ever entered an email to order something online, you get a million emails today about Cyber Monday. Also in Austin, Neo Ash 1 tweets, "Wow, I can't believe we already have a day named after the Tesla Cybertruck. How did Elon Musk do this?"
Yeah.
Speaking of other 90s fever dreams there, the Cybertruck. In Dallas, Christine Duzich, she says her husband says Cyber Monday is cyberbullying their finances. Whoa!
Mm.
But a bit more seriously, Harris County Sheriff Ed Gonzalez has some solid advice for online shopping.
Oh?
He notes that you should use a single credit card or prepaid card. Check your bank statements for fraudulent purchases and avoid using public or unsecured Wi-Fi. And lastly, know when your packages are being delivered, because, you know, that's when we see the most fraud in that respect is when they're swiped from your doorstep.
It's got to be a thing with those Ring videos. Yep. You've seen those, the little Ring camera videos, people just lifting packages.
I know,
it's
crazy. And it's become really prevalent in lots of neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I should just work this in. Speaking of Black Friday, books are always a thoughtful present.
And
in case you've been seeking some suggestions for that special someone, on Friday, we had a whole show dedicated to some of our favorite books and author interviews from the year. I know a lot of stuff gets lost in the shuffle over that long Thanksgiving holiday weekend. So folks can visit our website, texasstandard.org, or wherever they get their podcasts to listen to that episode and our Thursday special as well, our Thanksgiving special, which cast a spotlight on mental health issues. Or as one of our fans, Ada R. Gullenkazi noted on Twitter, she said, "Texas Standard dedicated their entire Thursday episode to mental health and their Friday episode to books, opening with a recommendation for a novel set in East Texas looking at race and white supremacy." Amazing.
Yeah, there were some terrific lists that were offered by our guests, and we had some wonderful author interviews as well in that program. Not to be missed, especially if you are one of those literary types and like you give books and that sort of thing.
Books are nice.
They
can't
really
go
are.
Wrong with a book for a present.
You cannot. Absolutely. Hint, hint. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I think if you missed those two broadcasts, you definitely should check them out. The one on mental health that ran on Thursday on Thanksgiving Day was a genuinely special edition of The Standard. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but the news continues over at texasstandard.org. That's where you can check out those two programs, by the way. We're going to be back here tomorrow. We hope you will, too. On behalf of the entire Texas Standard crew, I'm David Brown, wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.